Music Fans, Alton Brown here. This is the Alton Brown Cast. Thanks for joining us. We've got a pretty cool show today. We are going to be talking about a lot of science. And when I say that, I mean, of course, food science and doing cool things with food science. And the reason for that is that is our guest. This is a guy that most of you have never heard of, but anyone who is anyone in the food business, well, that's not true. Anybody who's into new culinary technologies and who is into kind of using science for cooking knows this guy. His name is Philip Preston, and he owns a company called Polyscience. And Polyscience, over the last, I don't know, 20 years, I would say, has made more of a difference in high-end gastronomy than any other company, because of very specific devices that he has created that some of you have seen on Iron Chef America and Top Chef and Next Iron Chef and other shows. So we're going to be visiting with Philip Preston, who, by the way, may be the most, well, let's just say he's probably the smartest guy that I know. Who will actually talk to me. A fascinating character, a wonderful inventor, and a guy who is plugged into a lot more of the high-end culinary people in this country than I could ever dream of being. So stand by, Philip Preston on the show, and the show is starting in about, well, let's just do it right now. So this is the Alton Brown Cast. Alton Brown here. This week we're recording from Chicago, Illinois, where Philip Preston, well, you don't actually live in Chicago. You live, no. You're Chicago adjacent.
Yes. Yes, in Northfield, Illinois.
Northfield, which is, in any given day, either half an hour away or 2 hours away, depending on what's going on and what, the Eisenhower, which one of the roads
yeah, the
is...
Kennedy.
Yeah, the
Kennedy.
The Kennedy, all right, because there's only two here. It's the Eisenhower and the Kennedy. So any of you who are foodists or fans of cuisine will have heard this man's name, Philip Preston's name, because of his company, Polyscience, which some people, I'm not going to say who said this, Philip, but there is or there are a couple of people that have suggested that you are as key to the current state of American high cuisine as anyone who calls themselves a chef because of your inventions. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think that might be a little bit of an overstatement, but you know, I just provide the tools, and the creativity comes from the guys who really know how to cook.
The guys that really know how to cook. Well, you have created, in your company, Polyscience, have created several devices that certainly fans of food television shows like Iron Chef America would recognize over the last few. Well, I don't know. When was the first year that you remember there being an immersion circulator, one of your circulators on the in the kitchen of Iron Chef America?
Oh, I remember the day.
It was 2006, wasn't it?
Yeah, 2006. I think it was Wiley Dufresne.
It was Wiley Dufresne and against.
Oh, boy. Now you're challenging.
Pretty sure it was Mario Batali. I believe that was Mario Batali.
Okay. A tough one. And I know Wiley was challenged with the tilapia as the ingredient.
Which we're all challenged by tilapia. Yeah. It's the fish that never gives any giving. Terrible. Well, no, that's not true. It is the most unfishy of all fish.
Yes.
It has actually no flavor. It's the Soylent Green of fish,
yeah.
But that's okay. And so you saw your device there. And for those in the audience who may not be familiar, tell them what this device did and does.
It is precise temperature cooking. So really what we're doing is reversing the traditional approach of exposing food to very high heat, relying on precise timing, and utilizing precise temperature, which opens up the time window dramatically to give you that perfect result every time.
What he's saying, kids, is that his devices, or most of his devices, are about putting food exactly in the thermal range that you want them. And this opens up an entire world of culinary possibilities. Imagine being able to poach an egg in its shell and hold it there for
potentially throughout 8-10 hours
of service.
Yeah,
if you were in a restaurant.
Yeah.
And the first few times that I saw one of those devices being used, eggs were the subject. Eggs were clinking around inside the bath and being held at that exact temperature, which put the real buzz into most of our heads. Those of us that were classically trained to believe that there are very, very few liquid temperatures that you can trust and control, you just can't do it. I've been trying to do it in ovens, you know, for a long time, and that's very, very difficult thing to do.
Yeah, you typically in a kitchen, your temperature control is plus or minus 10 degrees or something in that range.
That's if you're very, very good.
Yeah. And for us, we're typically controlling to somewhere in a few hundredths of a degree.
a few hundredths of a degree. So you came out, your company came out with these immersion circulators, which became digitally controlled, because the very first one that I had, at least, wasn't digitally controlled. Mm-hmm. It had a big knob on it. Then you got digital control. That opened up the whole sous vide market, and we'll talk about that in a second, or the whole sous vide kind of world empire. You also went the opposite direction with the anti-griddle, which is something that I still want to put my tongue on every time I see it, but I know better. You invented the smoking gun, which is very popular with restaurant chefs. And now you've gotten into sonic treatments of things, which I want to talk about. But let's go back to the early days. This was your dad's company, right?
Yeah.
And it was a laboratory supply company,
right,
basically.
Right. He founded the company in 1963. And he was a professor of chemical engineering. And in 1963, he decided to found his own business, which consisted of publications, the Journal of Chromatographic Science, the Journal of Analytical Toxicology, just some light reading.
I just renewed last week.
And then he would start a business around all of his hobbies. He started Photo Techniques magazine and a wide range of things. But PolyScience was always focused on temperature control equipment. But in that realm, we're controlling temperature of, say, viscosity samples or cooling of electron microscopes or CAT scan and PET scan systems. So liquid temperature control was our specialty from the onset. It wasn't until the early 2000s that I realized that I could combine my hobby of cooking with my career of temperature control.
Tell us about that nexus. How did that happen?
Well, actually, it started with a phone call to our customer service department from Matthias Merges, who was at the time chef de cuisine for Charlie Trotter. And
here in Chicago.
Yes, yes. And our customer service person that took the call knew that I loved to cook, and so she transferred the call to me, and I'd had to jump in the car and see what on earth he was talking about with precise temperature cooking. And so
what did he request? What was it he was calling for?
He wanted an immersion circulator for the kitchen. He had seen the technique used in France and wanted to try and explore that. And here he said he had tried controlling the temperature on a stovetop with little success. And so I came over there, and the next thing I knew, we were cooking at Charlie Trotter's, and I think they ended up with 11 circulators in that kitchen cooking almost all their proteins and vegetables.
So I'm curious, he calls you up. What year is this again? 19?
Somewhere around 05.
Okay, so it was actually, as you said, over 2000. So it's 2005. Yeah. Matthias calls you up. He tells you about seeing a system in France. What were they using in France?
Well, they were just using some laboratory equipment that had been repurposed.
And no, it wasn't your stuff, though.
I don't think it was. I know Bruno Gousseau, who was involved with the founding of the technique, in his lab, there's probably everybody who ever made a temperature controller's unit.
Is there.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this starts at Charlie Trotter's, and then what happened? Just describe how the events unfolded to the point where you realized that, I mean, I don't know how much of your company now really concentrates on culinary versus lab applications, but it's got to be.
It's significant, but it's still somewhere maybe 20%, something of that nature. But it was the application that I found to be incredibly fun, given the fact that I had actually studied French cooking in night school early in my career, just as a hobby. I've always loved cooking, gardening. And then after working with Matthias, actually one of the next calls I got was Wiley Dufresne,
who had some in New York.
Yes. And Wiley said, "I'm going on this TV show, Iron Chef." I said, I know the show. And he said, "I've got some old units that I bought on eBay, but he didn't want to have those sort of old beaters at that competition.
Yeah, in Kitchen Stadium. Yeah.
And so I told him I knew what he was doing and where do I ship the units.
And where do you ship the units? And that was that. Yeah. And that was the first time that I remember actually seeing PolyScience units. Mm-hmm. I remember walking up to them and just thinking, I have got to have me some of that. I remember very, 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 very clearly being terrifically amazed by that. So then all of a sudden people are seeing it being used by a guy like Wiley, who's definitely a sharpened stick, using your stuff on national television. Then how quickly did things happen after that?
Quite rapidly. You know, I found that there would – but, you know, still it was – very much a hobby business for me. We were just, we weren't really marketing to the culinary market. I had no insight that it would actually blossom into something real. And then shortly after that, Grant Achatz and Nick Kokonas came by the office to see what we were doing in preparation for the opening of Alinea restaurant here in Chicago. And that's when Grant saw that we actually build more refrigerated products than heating products. And so he was intrigued with the refrigeration systems and asked if I could make a very cold plate, which evolved to the anti-griddle. And the reality is when I built that unit for him, I honestly thought I'd only build two, one for him and one for me. And that now that evolved to also another fairly popular system that's used in a lot of different applications. I always thought it would just be pastry, but or dessert course type of things. Of course, Grant, being who he is, the first thing he put on there was smoked salmon, and used a microplane on the frozen salmon. For me, it's always been creme anglaise and things like that. But it opened up kind of another fun realm for me and got me exploring all sorts of other interesting things.
Well, the anti-griddle is and for those of you who don't have access to an anti-griddle or even a Polyscience catalog, tell them the website so they can at least drop by and look at everything.
Yeah, it's www.cuisinetechnology.com.
And check this thing out. The anti-griddle is about the size of a bread box, large bread box, and has a surface that's, how many inches by how many inches? It's about 14 by 18 or something like that. I had my eyes on one last week, but I don't remember. and what is the potential surface temperature?
It runs at about minus 30 and stainless steel top. So it allows you to very rapidly unidirectionally freeze things.
Yeah.
And so you could have a frozen bottom and a liquid top. And it's strange that there's actually nothing in a kitchen that currently does that.
No. I tried to make something that does that, building a very specialized flask for liquid nitrogen, but could not ever get and I never got it right. Let's just put it that way. I tried and wasted a lot of money on stainless steel attempting to make an anti-griddle with liquid nitrogen, which I'm pretty sure I could get to work eventually, but it's not as easy. It's just plugging up and flipping on an anti-griddle. My favorite thing on the anti-griddle was to play with things on acetate sheets because you don't have to worry about getting it off. You know, you just lay the sheet down and you can, you know, especially with chocolates and things, move things around, roll them and whatnot.
Yeah, create some interesting patterns.
Oh, yeah.
I've also seen some really interesting work with dressing a salad where olive oil and balsamic will thaw at different temperatures. Mm-hmm. And so creating a pattern and then putting the sheet on the salad and the diner gets to see the evolution of the
or the
de-evolution.
On how you think about it. Yeah, because, I mean, there are a lot of things that will freeze at 30 below that, you know, don't ordinarily freeze. So now your company is considered – well, any serious chef's got some of your stuff in their kitchen, I think. Mm-hmm. I mean, most of the people that I talk to, certainly on shows like Iron Chef America, I see your stuff constantly.
Yeah.
And certainly in the immersion circulator end of things, if there's any tool of yours that I use, that's actually like become standard equipment in my kitchen, is a circulator. And I use it on all kinds of things. You know, before that device, you know, seeing a piece of meat and what would happen to certain meats when they're held at very specific temperatures for long periods of time, we've never seen that. None of us had ever seen that. How can you break down the connective tissue in something like a beef rib without overcooking the beef rib? I mean, it's not possible any other way that I know of.
It offers a lot of unique attributes. For me, one of the things that I love the most about it is that I don't worry about when guests are showing up for a dinner party or when we're when we all decide it's time to eat, because I get such a big window of time to get the absolute perfect result. The other thing that I find that, you know, if I'm entertaining a lot of people, even things that I do stovetop, like a good example, mashed potatoes. Keeping mashed potatoes warm on a stovetop without burning the bottom is a real challenge. So putting those in a bag, and I'll just use these binder clips, put them, I'll have all these bags on the side of my sous vide bath in with my protein, and keeping everything at serving temperature. And it is a great way to de-stress a dinner party.
Sure, because you're not having to worry about the timing of everything. Mm-hmm. So you don't worry about vacuum bags. You just essentially use heavy-duty zip-top bags and gym mm-hmm. clip them to the top of the circuit of the bath.
Right.
And in that case, what are you using? What do you usually use at home for a bath? And you use one of your items.
Actually, what I typically am using is a small Cambro tank, a food storage tank.
Yeah.
Either that or a stock pot.
Yeah, stock pot's the easiest.
Right.
Everybody's got one, and it's easy to clip things or mm-hmm. tie things around the side of it. So all of a sudden, the stress goes away. Do you always just use water?
I do. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I've heard of people using some pretty wacko liquids.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I've heard at the French Laundry filling tubs of butter, filling tubs of milk, beef stock. Mm-hmm. And so poaching in those liquids is possible. I just don't have that much to cook that it justifies it.
Yeah.
If I ever want to poach in a, let's say, lobster poached in butter, and if I ever felt the need where I'd put in some few pads of butter in the bag, it wasn't adequate. I've seen it done where it seems more efficient to take one of those little containers like you'd find salad dressing at the smorgasbord, mm-hmm. Put a few sticks of butter in that, and set that in one of my baths.
Right.
So it gets controlled very precisely.
Agreed. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to melt 15 pounds of butter.
Yeah.
I mean, I like it fine, but I'm just not going to do that. And at a home kitchen, I typically don't have several gallons of stock hanging around.
Right.
Do you find that now, of course, the sous vide, I'm not going to call it a revolution, but certainly a movement in this country, mm-hmm. At using those words, sous vide, as a method, which you have certainly kind of adopted and use in your materials, as a method that came from Europe, from France primarily, has really, well, took off here. How long has it been, would you say? I mean, it really maybe 20 years ago, 15 years ago that people really started talking about it?
I think very few people in the U.S. were talking about it back then.
Okay, when do you think it became something?
I think
that
some
everybody
of the early
about?
Adopters here were in early 2000.
Okay, so we're talking about a 10-year, a decade old
right.
trend here.
Right.
Do you think that it has really changed? Of course, what the sous vide means under vacuum, technically speaking.
Yeah.
Right. You're making funny faces, like you.
Yeah, because it's a term I've never liked.
Okay, why don't you like it?
Well, because under vacuum has very little to do with the cooking technique. Really, the cooking technique is very precise temperature control, and it is precise temperature cooking. There is really no need to have product under a vacuum to do it properly. I've done it many, many times with just squeezing air out of a Ziploc bag. And actually, pulling a deep vacuum on things, one thing I hate to see, for example, if I go into a restaurant and I see fish was done sous vide and the vacuum sealer was cranked up, and so the fish now has flat edges from being too compressed.
Right.
Also, I think pulling a deep vacuum on food introduces unnecessary risk of anaerobic bacteria.
And we're talking, of course, about things that result in botulism, the B word.
Yes.
Because that's an anaerobic. I don't like the term either, sous vide, because number one, it's French, and I just find it's just too fussy. But it skirts the point, because mm-hmm. I'm with you. When people talk to me about wanting to pull really deep vacuum off food, it scares the bejeebers out of me, mm-hmm. because I don't want to mess with anaerobic bacteria, and I don't want to change the textures of food that much. The only time I want to do that is I'll do that with fruit, because you can definitely change the texture of a fruit, and you can infuse flavors into mm-hmm. things, and I will do that, but I don't know when I've ever done it with a piece of protein.
Right. And for me, I look at really, it's unfortunate they didn't come up with a wonderful French term for just precise temperature cooking. And when we think of cooking in a water bath, the whole reason you pull a vacuum is so the product doesn't float, and so you get good thermal conductivity to all sides of the product.
Because otherwise it just sits there and bobs on the surface, and you've got to put a chain on it or something. And then, of course, the air is in and of itself
an insulator,
and so you've got air in the bag, and you don't get good contact.
Yeah, so what you want to do really is look at this from, I want to bring that product to a very precise temperature uniformly, and through doing that, you'll get that perfect result and not have to introduce unnecessary risk in the process. But what a lot of people just, you know, we're all aware of it, but we don't really think of it, that thermal conductivity in water is 100 times greater than that of air. You know, you can reach in an oven all day and pull dinner rolls out barehanded, but you don't pull your hard-boiled eggs out of the bath.
Not without biting down on a big wooden spoon before I stick my hand in. Yeah, that would be psychotic. Do you think that people are now kind of overusing the device or using it in a way that is not properly suitable to the food?
I haven't seen that so much. Actually, I think that the unfortunate thing is some people don't realize all of its benefits. You know, even if you were cooking, you know, proteins in a traditional fashion, which, you know, it hasn't replaced a single tool in my kitchen. It's just added one more. But that ability to keep things at a holding temperature without degradation, I think, is one of the areas that I don't see people really utilizing it as fully as they could.
Right.
You know, once you've got this capability, you might as well exploit it and open up that window of time, enjoy your guests, enjoy the dinner party. The other thing that is phenomenal is what you can do in catering events. I volunteered to cater my brother's wedding I thought was going to be about 30 people in a tent in northern Wisconsin.
And then it turned into 100, didn't it?
200.
200. That's what happens at weddings. I don't understand why that happens.
You know, without sous vide equipment, I would have been sunk.
Right, yeah. Because you couldn't hold.
Yeah, yeah. I had four outlets in a tent in the woods and four sous vide baths, a Weber grill, and one of those propane turkey deep fryers. Just to crisp the skin on confit duck legs that I had done, and beef tenderloin and confit duck legs and carrots, everything perfect. And, you know, it's just unheard of for one person to cater an event like that.
It's interesting. When I think about how your circulators have changed the way that I cook at home, I look at it very often now as the primary cooking device. I mean, I will take a chicken, a whole chicken, and I will bag it up, and I will put some oil and some other seasonings in there. I will suck out all the air literally with a straw in the corner, you know, in my mouth, which my daughter can't believe I do. And I will leave the gosh darn thing in there all day. I'll put it in the bath in the morning. I will leave it there. And then right before I serve the chicken, I plop it on a rack, and I have this thing called a Luftleiter. Have you ever seen a Luftleiter?
No.
A Luftleiter is a Swedish device that's basically a blow dryer on steroids. It's used to light charcoal, which it does amazingly quickly. So it is a high power heat gun, and I will simply finish off the skin of the chicken with a Luftleiter.
Wow, I like it.
I mean, and it takes maybe 2 minutes. I can be very strategic on where I brown and how I brown. And then I let it rest for a couple of minutes and serve the gosh darn thing. But it's literally, I now think of charring and searing is a last minute. It's not part of the main cooking anymore. It's just a quick finish.
Yeah.
Which allows me to use all kinds of different devices like a Luftleiter. So it's like I look at my grill and it's like, yeah, I could do that. But on a day-to-day basis, on a weeknight, I'm not. I'm sticking it in the bath and calling it a day.
I know, and I've struggled with using torches because I'm always a little concerned about infusing flavors of butane or propane into the food or even MAP gas.
Yeah.
And it just takes so long to get a good uniform browning on a piece of meat.
Luftleiter. The Luftleiter. Okay. I strongly advocate the Luftleiter. Yeah, it costs about $80, I think, for a Luftleiter. Now, I have used big format torches. There's this company in Kansas that makes this thing called a Red Dragon. Have you ever seen a Red Dragon?
No.
The Red Dragon is a torch that is designed to burn weeds around chain link fences.
Okay. And 4-foot handle on it, probably.
The handle's about 4 feet long, and the nozzle's about 8 inches in circumference, and it's got a pressure trigger on one end, and it'll blow a pretty serious – it'll blow a flame about – Jim, what is that, two and a half, 3 feet of flame
on the Red Dragon? Maybe two.
2 feet. So – and that big. So it's basically like a jet engine. It hooks up to a big propane tank. And so what I do when I do my ribs for a bunch of people in the bath of yours is I will put them on racks on the ground or someplace, and I just – I pretend I'm burning down a village. I give it about – all of them, I can take 25 pounds of ribs, and in 45 seconds to 1 minute, everything's charred.
That'll get their attention, too.
It is ringing the dinner bell, because this thing makes a lot of sound. You know, it's like a hot air balloon when they fire the heaters on a hot air balloon, that roar. This thing does that, so it's pretty. So I recommend the Luftleiter and the Red Dragon. No, don't mess around with any of these hand torches anymore. They take too long. Yeah. But I've never thought about getting funny flavors from either propane or butane, because the burn is typically pretty clean.
And I haven't had that experience, but I just always feel a little bit like, I don't know, this thing that's made to, put together copper pipes.
Can that be a good thing?
Yeah.
I don't know. Years of eating.
I like the hair dryer on steroids.
The hair dryer, the Luftleiter, it'll absolutely get you there. Right. So you moved on from the immersion circulator, and Grant asked for a very cold surface, so you made the anti-griddle. Where did the smoking gun come from? Because that's not about temperature control.
I know. The smoking gun came from I walked into a store, CompUSA, to get some software, and I was browsing all the gadgets. Mm-hmm. And I came across something that was described as a keyboard vacuum cleaner.
Yeah, sure. It's a little canister with a tube with a brush on the end.
I just stood there thinking to myself, this is the stupidest device. Who would put four AA batteries in something rather than turn the keyboard upside down or wipe it down with a paper towel? And I don't know, a light bulb went on. I bought two of them, drove from the CompUSA store to the hardware store, and 20 minutes later I had the first smoking gun. So then I thought, this is just kind of a fun thing. I never really intended to market them, but I built a handful. And I remember just Wiley Dufresne had invited me to WD-50, and so as a gift I gave him one. Mm-hmm. Well, he liked it, and then showed it to other people, and so I kept building these things.
So all you have to do is give it to either Grant or Wiley and let them show it around, and pretty soon you've got orders, right?
Exactly, yeah. And so then it meant I was either going to say to people, no, I'm not building any more of these, or I actually had to tool it. And so we tooled it up.
Because you were making them like on your workbench at home thing, right?
Yeah.
Literally. Were you making it then out of the keyboard vacuums?
Yes.
You were using that chassis, that platform?
Exactly. Yeah, okay. That was the blower motor. But then, chefs started lighting them with torches, and we had this wooden bowl that would catch fire, and then
that's not a very smart material for the but a pipe. I mean,
if you used a match or a light, a regular Bic lighter, it worked fine. But and then they started melting the plastic blades and the blower. Yeah. And so we tooled it up so it had a big aluminum head on it with aluminum blades on it. And so a little more robust, easier to clean.
For those of you that don't know, this is essentially a handheld device that looks a lot like a keyboard vacuum, except it's got a little bowl on top, and you put your wood or your herb or whatever it is you're gonna burn in there, and it has a long tube, and you hit a button which turns on the fan, and you light it, and of course the pull of air through the device maintains the burn, and smoke comes out the other end.
Yes.
And I've watched the evolution of the device. Iron Chef America has been a great place to kind of watch your lineup change over the years. I could actually kind of build a timeline just out of watching how the smoking gun has changed over the years. But is it a a lot of people don't realize, you can't get a lot of smoke flavor into food in that amount of time. It takes more time than that, but you can.
And it depends.
Okay, go ahead. Explain.
Now, it depends because, I'll have people that'll call up and say, okay, I pointed it at a chicken, shot it for 5 minutes, and then roasted it, and I didn't notice anything. Yeah, well, it's not going to work for that. Whereas if you took a mixer and just whipped up some butter and then put some plastic wrap over the top and hit it for 2 minutes with, say, an apple smoke, it's a wonderful flavor. And it is a very pronounced wood flavor. It's great. You'd serve it today on with just bread and butter at a party. And then tomorrow, a great trick if you ever are serving vegetarians, you saute
serving
the potatoes.
Them as no. The course? Or you mean you're serving for two vegetarians? Four. Okay, yeah. I'm sorry.
And you saute potatoes maybe in the smoked butter. And they'll swear you used bacon. It's just that.
And they get all indignant.
Right.
I can't believe you did that. Yeah. I actually bored a hole in the top of my Vitamix mixer so that I could run the tube in there.
Oh, okay.
Because I found that the smoking gun, that is its single best application, is feeding things into a blender.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't work as well. I can't get it to work as well in a food processor, but it works very well in the blender. And I think that's because it literally, at the right viscosity liquid, at the right speed, literally pulls the smoke down kind of into that vortex.
Right.
And distributes it. And I make what I'd like to think is a pretty wickedly wonderful Eggs Benedict without meat. And I smoke the hollandaise.
Ooh, I like
and
that.
And that, believe it or not, works with the eggs very, very well. I haven't. Uh-huh. I've been trying to find someone who's written a study about solubility of smoke particulate in fats, because I do believe that fats hold on to smoke better than proteins do. But I can't find anybody who's quantified that really.
Yeah, right.
I may just
right.
be looking in the wrong places. But that's my favorite use for the smoking gun.
My favorite is actually smoking water in a Vitamix and then making ice cubes, and you serve bourbon on the rocks with smoked ice.
Shut up. Really? Water?
Yeah.
Water will take the smoke.
Oh, it takes smoke beautifully. And it's one of those things where you'll hand someone the drink and they'll say, oh, yeah, I kind of know. They're being polite. Yeah, I notice a little smoke. And then 5 minutes later, after the ice has melted a little bit, it's like, wow. It's a whole different drink. Continuously evolving.
I wonder if you could put it into an old-fashioned CO2 seltzer bottle. Add the water. Smoke it, then seal it up and carbonate it, whether you would get.
I would expect you would.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So we could have smoke soda
yeah.
in your scotch.
Yeah.
Think what
yeah.
that could do for some cheap scotch.
Exactly. Yeah. Actually, cool. I could revolutionize.
Give me a bottle of scotch up here in a seltzer bottle on stat.
Yeah. I think we can revolutionize the whole liquor industry. We'll use the ultrasonic sonic prep to take some grain alcohol, we'll barrel age it in 3 minutes with ultrasonics, and then we'll add smoke.
Okay,
call it scotch.
Let's back up and have you explain that for a second. I've read. I do not possess the sonic prep yet. That's what you're calling it, right? Sonic
yes.
prep. Tell me exactly how that works. I explain to folks. This is basically a box. There's a wave generator and a probe, and you put the probe inside the substance, a liquid,
right.
typically, and it goes inside the sound box. Now, tell us what happens in there.
Well, basically, shooting the sound waves through the liquid acts as a pump, pumping 20,000 pulses per second. It is what sous vide is to very gentle cooking. The sonic prep is the inverse of that. It is an extremely violent reaction that's taking place.
But it's a physical reaction. You're
yes.
basically shaking it in a way. You're vibrating yeah. that liquid at a very intense right. wave level.
Yes. And the thing I love to do with it most is actually barrel aging.
Explain.
So I'll grow some apples, ferment them, distill them, and then float wood chips on top of it, and in a matter of 3 minutes, put 3 years of barrel age on it.
So I've got this liquid. Let's say that I'm not going to start with growing the apples. I'm,
right.
I'm not actually going to make the Calvados.
Okay.
Let's say that I start with, we'll say Calvados for not having a better example here. And I'm going to put this in a beaker, let's just say, because I got one laying around, big old Pyrex beaker.
Sure.
Now, I take wood chips. Apple, we'll say it's Apple because that seems to make the
I
most
sense.
I just
happen to have a lot of them with the gun around. I have lots of those.
Absolutely, you do. So let's say I've got Apple chips, okay? Handful. Apple chips. I've got the Calvados, which, of course, has already been distilled, is already an alcohol. And I put that in there, and I stick the probe in, and I close the door. What is going on scientifically to explain how I can get flavor out of those wood chips in how long?
About 3 minutes.
About 3 minutes. Okay, explain to me how that happens.
Well, the ultrasonic sound waves are... they're fairly powerful with this system and are sending out pulses, 20,000 pulses per second, which acts as a pump, pumping the liquid through the fibers of the apple wood chip and exchanging flavor very rapidly between the two. The very first thing I used it for was making mojitos. I like
how you always default to liquor. I like that. It's like, let's make a drink. So walk me through the mojito process.
And putting the mint leaves in the simple syrup in a glass and then hitting them with ultrasonic, I was able to move all the mint flavor, exchange it to the simple syrup.
Without
and
using
yet
heat.
The leaves didn't even look bruised. And so, no mechanical muddling going on.
No.
It was
to heck with muddling.
Yeah,
muddling's
right.
too old school for what we're talking about.
Yeah.
So I could literally put a year or two, or as you say, even more years of age on a liquor from the barrel aging standpoint.
Right.
What else could I do?
Well, some of the areas that, this is an area too, ultrasonics, I'm still exploring with some mixed result. For example, I've built some emulsions with it. And while it will build a phenomenal emulsion, I can take balsamic and olive oil and create what almost looks like a paste that will stick for weeks. But when I work with fats, for an unknown reason, I can get sometimes a bit of a metallic taste that I don't quite have a handle on what the cause is.
Ooh.
So I'm always careful with it. So if I'm building an emulsion, what I might do is use a traditional, say, the stick blender, something like that, build the emulsion, and then just a very rapid finish with ultrasonics so I avoid any imparting any bad flavors. You see, this is the advantage of a privately held business in that we can do things that make no sense at all because
God
we think it's fun.
That. Yeah, best reason for doing it, right?
So marketing an ultrasonic flavor infusion system is one of those things that I just thought it was really interesting, really a fun thing to do, and so not really something that I think is going to keep the lights on at Polyscience, but it certainly is. Something we're having a lot of fun with.
How often do you find that something that you develop for culinary purposes comes around and helps to bolster your lab side? In other words, is the food R&D actually doing anything for developing new ideas on the lab side?
We've had one example of that actually, where I always said the anti-griddle, the very first product I built exclusively for the culinary market. And we had a dinner party, and a good friend came over, and I was making dessert on the anti-griddle. Well, he's a dermatologist, and he specializes in Mohs surgery. And he said, that's exactly what I need in my lab as a histology freeze plate. So the exact opposite of a cooking technique. He wanted to freeze tissue samples extremely rapidly. And so... I guess when they cut something bad, they have to inspect the perimeter to make sure they got all of the bad cells, and they need to do this very rapidly while the patient is still in surgery.
Yeah, that's the and definition of that surgery. It's done in situ.
Yeah. So the anti-griddle actually also became marketed as the histology freeze plate.
Nice.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned being a privately held company. That kind of that method of research and development would be very tough to do in a publicly held company when you've got a lot of people yelling at you about things. But to be able to come up with that kind of creative problem solving is, I don't know, I think kind of what American inventiveness is all about.
Yeah. Personally. I think actually one of the biggest frustrations I see is most of the engineers in the world, I think, are working on product evolution. And, you know, what I refer to when I go to a trade show, I'll walk in and I say, oh, look, there's a new button on the dishwasher. And I think very few people are really working on product innovation, something really new that we haven't seen before.
Do you think that's because it's so hard to market new to people who are used to doing things a certain way?
Well, I actually think that it's because you have a tremendous failure rate in product innovation. You know, you realize after 6 months of working on something that, yeah, if I only had an obtainium, I could get this to work.
Damn, no unobtainium. Still out. Still right. Unobtainable.
Right.
Okay, you've got temperature control pretty much down with the circulators. You've tackled sonics.
Tried to.
I know in your catalog, whether you're making them or not, I know, but you're selling rotovap technology.
Right.
Which is a whole other wonderful ball of wax.
It is.
My wife keeps telling me I'll get one this year. I'm not sure if I believe her yet. Are you guys actually making that now? Or
no, we work with a company that's one of the leaders in that field, Heidolf. And actually, we have a relationship going back to the early 60s with Heidolf, where we provide the temperature control systems, the chillers needed to cool the condensers on the rotary evaporators. So we've had this longstanding relationship, and I just think it's a really fun tool for a culinary application.
It goes right back to that liquor, though. I mean, it's great to be able to reduce things without heat, but it's really nice to be able to make your own brandy. But what do you see as being next? What's going on in your head now?
What's going on in my head is I've been working on a few ideas in food safety. Mm-hmm. See, I have everywhere I turn, from my home kitchen, where if I make that gallon of soup or chili or stock, I don't know what to do with it. It sits on the stovetop until it's cool enough that I think it won't take out the milk in the fridge sitting next to it. And I really find that both in the home kitchen and in the professional kitchen, it's quite cumbersome.
Very.
It's not uncommon that restaurants will make 5-gallon pots of something, put it in the walk-in cooler, and you could come back the next day and probe the core, and it's still in the danger zone.
Oh, it's still in the zone. It's somewhere between 40 and 140. And it's also made everything else in the box warmer, conversely. Yeah.
So I see utilizing our expertise in temperature control, our knowledge of food. There's challenges, though, with this. How do you cool something rapidly and not break the beans in the chili or the noodles in the chicken soup or coat the fats and gelatins out on the mechanism you're using to cool? And so it isn't that easy. I will say, I have built one unit after using it in my own kitchen. I just don't think I think it's too cumbersome. It's too big to store, too cumbersome to use. But at least I was able to prove the concept, taking a gallon of soup from roughly 85 centigrade to 20 centigrade in a minute. And then using what I referred to as thermal batteries, just recharge, pull some parts out of the freezer, put them on this unit again, and then took it from 20 centigrade down to roughly about 5 centigrade. So in a matter of 2 minutes, we were able to go from just below boiling to refrigerator temperature.
You want to share any other angles on how you made that possible?
Well, I think I have to go back to what is in everyone's kitchen, whether it's a professional kitchen or the home cook. We all have the ability to make ice. And a lot of people don't really, we all realize it, but we're not necessarily cognizant of the fact that there's a tremendous amount of power in phase transfer.
Huge.
And, just to prove it to myself once. I just took a 1 liter beaker of water, somewhere around plus 20 degrees centigrade room temperature, and I wanted to get it to minus 20. So I put it in a glycol bath at minus 20 and data logged the core temperature. And in rough estimates, mm-hmm. it took about 40 minutes to go from plus 20 to plus 1.
Okay.
It took another 40 minutes to go from plus 1 to minus 1. And so, and then another 40 minutes to go from minus 1 to minus 20. Well, that whole 40 minutes was storing energy. It was taking the energy for phase transfer, and you get all that back. We just don't notice how long those ice cubes in a drink last. They last an inordinate amount of time. They should never last that long. If you took a piece of steel out of the freezer that was the same size as that ice cube, it would warm in no time. You also need a scrubbing effect. You have to have something that will scrub the heat energy off of the surface that's chilled, you know, between the hot and the cold side. So, and getting that scrubbing effect without breaking the beans in your chili is the challenge. This, unfortunately, is one of those things, too, that is going to be like sous vide cooking, where it's totally new. People today don't even realize that they could get a lot more shelf life out of their chicken noodle soup if, in fact, they could chill it very rapidly. And so, you know, there's a huge educational component behind sort of all of these ideas.
Tell me briefly at home. You're farming, right?
Yeah, I actually am in construction on a barn right now. I've got...
besides the one that has the cars in it?
Yeah,
because
exactly.
You've already got that,
well,
right?
That's the Garage Mahal.
Okay, Garage Mahal. That's right, Garage Mahal. I love that expression. How many cars are in the Garage Mahal right now?
Oh, I don't know, maybe six or something. I have a weakness for cars.
Yeah, I'd say that's... Well, it's only a weakness if you can't afford them.
Well, you know, it's also, it's good fun. You know, it's a hobby. You go out and work on the car. You always have that excuse. I need to go work on the car.
I got to work on the car. So anyway, you're building a barn.
I am. And putting in crops. We're going to be up to 26 fruit trees. We'll have roughly, I don't know, about a half an acre of crop. A lot of this really is, again, that pursuit of one of my hobbies. I've loved gardening, and I just... you know, thrilled to be able to take it to the level where I'm buying the big pack of seeds now instead of the little ones at the garden center. And also with my kids being, you know, 5, 6 years old, I think it's going to be a great lesson for them. And throughout all of this, I hope to donate a lot of the crop to the food bank.
To the food bank. Yeah. Do you see yourself getting to the point where you could make it through a season basically living off of your land?
Well, we're...
Because you got chickens too, right?
We do have chickens, yeah. And I look at chickens as the perfect insect control for the crop area. They give us eggs every day. And actually, before we put the farm area in, underneath it, put in 6 trenches, 6 feet deep with 600 feet of poly tubing in each trench for a horizontal geothermal field.
Of course you did.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you?
It all plays to temperature control. And so that will then heat and cool the house. And I have a plan. Next thing we're going to do is build... onto the house to incorporate a root cellar, which
is temperature control.
And is temperature control. Yeah. Right. So I think that'll give us at least some reasonable shelf life on root vegetables.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for doing what you do, and thanks for talking to us about it.
Thank you.
I think you have changed the culinary world in a good way. Well, and the fact that you've done it using your imagination and doing it just because you've wanted to, best reason of all.
Well, thanks, Alton. And always a pleasure to see you.
Pleasure was mine. Thank once again Philip Preston for being on some wonderful toys, and I'm saving up my pennies and dimes to buy more of them. All right, stick around sometime next week or thereabouts. There'll be another Alton Brown cast for you to delight in. Till then, America, cook smart.